from KQED.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This week, the United States marked a grim milestone, more than 200,000 deaths from the coronavirus pandemic. Against this backdrop, Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar moved to bar the National Health Agencies, including the Food and Drug Administration, from signing off on any new rules without his consent. Azar's sweeping declaration, called by some as a power grab, would affect regulation of the nation's foods, medicines, medical devices, and other products, including vaccines. That's according to a September 15th memo obtained by the New York Times. We're going to talk about the federal response to the pandemic and how the nation is faring in its fight against COVID-19. Joining us is James Hamblin, physician and staff writer for The Atlantic and co-host of the Social Distance podcast. His most recent book is Clean, The New Science of Skin. Welcome, Dr. Hamblin. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo with us. She is professor and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UCSF's School of Medicine. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Bibbins-Domingo.
Thank you.
Thank you. And let me begin with you, if I may. And let me begin by getting your reaction, if I could, to what I had just mentioned about Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar actually saying that the national health agencies really ought to come under his signing off, whether it's FDA or whatever. It's being called a power grab. I'm just wondering what your reaction is to it.
Yeah, I think the main challenge throughout this pandemic is for the public to be able to look to our leaders and to trust in the decision-making process. And I think when you see these type of political maneuvering and when you hear inconsistent messaging from our leaders, I think that is the challenge. Really, is that it places the trust of the public in jeopardy, and all that we know about what we've learned from the public's perceptions of the vaccination that is coming down the road, of various policy interventions, is that the public's trust is the one thing that we are lacking and the one vital thing to be in place for us to move forward safely.
Yeah, I want to talk with you more about trust as this segment progresses, but let me go to, if I may, our other guest for just a moment here, James Hamblin. And James Hamblin, I'm interested in getting your response to something I signed off on that is on the air just yesterday. That has to do with a couple of significant things that occurred in Ohio at one of the rallies that President Trump was leading. That was just on Monday night. And I'm talking, of course, about the fact that the president went into some detail about how, I'll use his language here, that there's no vulnerability to COVID-19. I mean, it was extraordinary language. He seemed to say that young people are immune, and that's simply not the case. And I'm just wondering, you know, as someone who has been right on top of this for so long now, what your response was to that. I mean, there, especially coming on the heels of the Bob Woodward book.
Yeah, I think that the response to statements like that is best handled now by simply ignoring them, realizing that you have a completely unreliable narrator who is, for whatever reason, without speculating, giving dangerous false statements about really important public health information, about the basic science of it. And you know, there are times, I think, that as journalists, we've been threading the needle between do we need to debunk claims, and hash out ad context and hash out gray areas. Sometimes that's really valuable. But when you move into a space where you are making blatantly false statements, which the entire scientific and medical community would condemn as dangerous, not just disagree with, not say are false, but say, you know, that sort of misinformation will lead to people getting sick, potentially dying. I don't think we can understate how profoundly consequential that is in a moment like this, in American history.
Well, here's the President of the United States saying the coronavirus affects virtually nobody. I mean, it's extraordinary to think about that, and especially in light of the fact that he was suggesting that those under 18 have immensely strong immune systems, and this is after We have got numbers about a half million kids, in fact, with COVID, and young people as the main transmitters. But I want to get to something else that was quite significant in that Ohio appearance by the president. And that was a Republican Lieutenant Governor, John Husted, standing out in front of the crowd and saying, wear masks, and getting booed. I mean, he took out a mask that said Donald Trump, and here he said, you can wear this mask. And he was getting booed heartily. I mean, the response to this is it almost defies trying to find language to react to it. But I'd like to hear what you have to say, because he's influencing people in large numbers, influencing them to sit there and transmit to one another in large numbers. So
right.
By crowds that shouldn't even be in those numbers together and gathering.
He clearly holds a lot of sway over this audience. They will believe and follow what he says, seemingly without question on any issue, no matter the contradiction from any outside entities, that there is a cult-like psychology to it. So he also there has the power here to really help people by simply wearing a mask, by simply not contradicting his own health experts and the basic facts. If he could simply manage to do that, he would be doing a much less of a disservice to the American people. And he seems unable or unwilling even to do that.
Let me go back, if I may, to you, Dr. Bibbins Domingo, on this. I want your response as well. What these kind of what they reveal, what they portend when you have the president minimizing the threat and continuing to minimize the threat and calling, for example, the CDC head, Robert Redfield, confused and contradicting him on the time of the virus, of the vaccine, not being ready till mid to late 2021 is what Dr. Redfield said. And the president again contradicted that. We're dealing with some territory that is not only difficult territory, to put it mildly. I find myself struggling just with language. It's ineffable to try to describe what the response is to this. It's as if the president is saying there's going to be a vaccine ready in a matter of weeks, when you've got heads of CDC and our chief medical officer saying just the opposite. Totally antithetical to that.
Yeah, it's really unprecedented, and I think the impact will be quite long lasting. I think it's important to know how much the CDC has been the hallmark of trying to understand the science behind public health for so many years, and really the model for how many in the rest of the world look to building public health programs, and to regular communication when the science is just emerging, and how we can use our understanding of the latest science to design evidence-based public health practice. And I think the regular undermining of the CDC, of the other agencies in the government that are in charge of the pandemic, is really, it erodes trust, as we already said, but really it is particularly challenging at a time when we are still learning about this virus. We need to have be able to have the scientific discourse, and to be able to have our scientific institutions communicate about what we know at the science about at the present time, and what that means for our application to public health or our application to the design of vaccinations and other types of things. And to have that being eroded on a consistent basis, either in the political maneuverings behind the scenes or in the outright comments, challenging statements of these leaders, I think is really harmful and will be long lasting.
And political, I think, is the key word here, as you're saying. This is a president who said 34 times the virus will disappear, and has argued that blue states are the reason we're behind in high number of cases of coronavirus, and that he's doing a phenomenal job. But I'm also struck by something else that has emerged here, Dr. Hamlin, and that is the president talking about herd immunity, especially identifiable with the advocacy of White House advisor Scott Atlas, who has absolutely no expertise in infectious diseases, but it seems to have caught his attention, and he seems to think there's some merit there. He seems like he's an advocate.
From my reporting on that, I couldn't go so far as to say that Dr. Atlas is an advocate. There were some reports, I believe the Washington Post, that that relied on anonymous sources that said that the term herd immunity was being thrown around in planning discussions. I know President Trump has alluded to it. It's a complex topic that derives from immunization policy, and it refers to the ways in which people are vaccinated that creates immunity across a population such that there can't be significant outbreaks. Some people are misusing the term and saying that it is, could be a sort of strategy, which it's not. It's a concept from vaccination. It will be useful as we roll out this vaccination to the vaccines as they become available to think about, who needs to get vaccinated first, most effectively, to most effectively use the doses that we have initially to try to create immunity across populations. But it's not really relevant right now.
Isn't it also true that there really has, in fact, I think you interviewed Howard Foreman on this, who's a health policy professor at Yale. There really hasn't been no disease that has had full herd immunity. You get lower levels and you get outbreaks that are bigger or smaller. You get waves, really.
Right. That's not how diseases tend to move through through populations. It's a term from vaccination. So you would continue to see waves for a long time, foreseeably, if there were simply no vaccine. And the really important thing here is, I think there's a basic idea that a certain number of people in the population are going to get infected anyway, and the erroneous school of thought is, why not just have people get infected earlier, get it over with, get to our place of herd immunity, and move on with life? And the fact is that just wouldn't happen, that you would have more people get infected.
Well, we heard Rand Paul arguing with Dr. Fauci about this, didn't we?
Right. It's a seductive kind of idea, because no one wants shutdowns. No one wants to be stuck at home, away from family members and not doing the things that we love in life. No one's advocating. Everyone wants this to end immediately. And I think that's really important to note. But that if you simply went back to old ways of life, you would see many more people get sick than if we can continue to, moderate, do the best we can to distance and slow the spread of this until we have a vaccine and until we have better treatments. We can expect that the month over month, hopefully not year over year, but year over year, as we're turning into our second year of this, treatments will get better. It will be a more survivable condition that doctors will get better and at treating this. And even a length of stay in a hospital decreases from, say, 10 days to 7 days. That's very significant in one person's life, so every case that we can prevent or delay is valuable.
Again, James Hamlin is a physician and staff writer for The Atlantic, co-host of the Social Distance podcast. His most recent book is Clean, The New Science of Skin. And we're talking about how the United States is faring in its battle against the COVID pandemic. One other footnote about so-called herd immunity. A lot of people point to Sweden, and I've learned from James Hamlin, from Dr. Hamlin, that Sweden still bans gatherings of 50 or more people, and they actually have bans on religious gatherings and concerts and theatrical and cinema performances and all of those things. So the idea that everything is just out there that some people have is misguided. I go back to the thing that you brought up, Dr. Bibbins-Domingo, and Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, again, is professor and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UCSF School of Medicine. This is a question of trust, because in high-risk neighborhoods where transmission is particularly high, even in counties that seem to have better control over things, and I'm talking, of course, about particularly here in the Bay Area, I'm thinking about San Francisco and the high number of Latinx cases, about 50%, in fact, of them in San Francisco. That's only 15% of the population. You have a need for trust, and a need for trust particularly with the medical community. I know at UCSF you've worked a lot on that, and I'd like you to sort of describe what you've done. What you see as positive in it?
Sure. So trust is important, and I think it's important to recognize that COVID-19 has affected many of our poor and minority communities in the Bay Area, Latino communities in particular in San Francisco, and in Oakland, but also African American, Pacific Islander. These are communities that already have a level of health disparities, a greater burden of other types of illness, as well as a history of having interactions with the healthcare setting that doesn't continue to promote trust in healthcare, science, and medicine. And so then when you layer on this pandemic on top of this, and you now watch these communities really being disproportionately affected, if you see the milestone of 200,000 deaths across the US and realize that African Americans make up a quarter of those deaths, even though they're 13% of the population, that in the Bay Area and across California, that Latinos make up the majority still of the cases, even though there are much lower representation in the population. The pre-existing level of mistrust that medicine and science is going to take care of the needs in these communities is now amplified, that mistrust, because of what everyone is observing, which is the really disproportionate impact.
So we need a lot more.
What many of us at UCSF have been doing, I think, has been really working in close partnership with the community organizations. And I think this started early on in the pandemic with a really strong partnership with the Latino Task Force in San Francisco. And I think that partnership is what allowed us to go into the Mission District and to bring testing into the Mission District in this model that Dr. Havlier at UCSF and others have called test to care model, so that it's not just testing, but also engaging with community organization to actually do the type of follow-up care that's often required to make sure that people can in fact engage in our public health recommendations to isolate and quarantine, which is more difficult when people need to be out and working. The partnership has led to us being able to do testing to understand disease and transmission better in San Francisco and across the Bay Area. And it's also led to giving information back to these community organizations so that they can also advocate successfully for the types of policies like protection of wages when people have to isolate and are unable to work, which I really think are important for enabling communities to actually be able to engage in the type of public health recommendations that we're making.
And let me just say that that we really need more testing. Grant Colfax in San Francisco, health director, has done a lot, and health directors throughout the Bay Area, but in these underserved communities, in these indigent communities, and certainly communities of color, we still have dramatically lower numbers of tests and need to really bring them up in number. And speaking of numbers, I want to give out the number because I know many of you may want to join us with questions or comments. We're talking about the troubling federal response to the COVID-19 pandemic and what we can expect in terms of cases in the coming months, and we'll get into that as well, and certainly local concerns and concerns in communities that are underprivileged and communities of color. We do welcome your involvement in the program, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. I invite you to do that. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, please join us at 866-733-6786, or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook, or at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. Welcome to Forum. We're talking about the troubling federal response to the COVID-19 pandemic and what we can expect in terms of cases in the coming months. And we do invite your involvement. And if you have questions or comments or would like to join us, you can do that now by calling in toll-free at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us, forum@kqed.org. We're talking with James Hamlin, who's a physician and staff writer for The Atlantic and co-host of the Social Distance podcast, and Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, who's professor and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the UCSF School of Medicine. I'd just like to pursue one other thing with you, Dr. Bibbins-Domingo, if I could. When we're talking about Latinx and African-American populations, we're really talking about populations that have come to the attention of disproportionate numbers because of crowded housing, because of fear of losing work. There are many reasons, undocumented, of course, as well. So we need much more easy access of testing for people who are in those situations, but we also need places for them. I mean, whether it's a hotel room or what it is, there has to be an infrastructure, doesn't there? Strong infrastructure?
Yeah. Yes, exactly right. I think the issue that that we're seeing is that that cycle of the essential worker, the people who are doing low wage frontline work, being exposed in work environments because people are out and not sheltered at home, also in congregate living settings, but then taking that exposures and bringing it home to more densely populated living environments, housing environments. That's worse here in the Bay Area because of our affordable housing crisis. And that cycle is really what is fueling a lot of what we are seeing. You are absolutely right. We need more testing, and not only do we need more testing in general during this pandemic, but we need testing that is directed really to communities where transmission is highest. We always talk about the positivity rate, and it tells you whether we're under testing, but we also have to think of that at a really very, very local level and say it's great that San Francisco is doing well, but we also have to make sure that the areas where transmission is still high in San Francisco are also doing well, and direct our resources like testing and other of the types of services that are needed in order to achieve the public health practices that we want to happen. You bring up the issue of housing. I think it's great that there has been a response to thinking about how to make hotel rooms available when people need to isolate or quarantine. That has been a really important feature in our pandemic response. I think you see around the Bay Area that response has been better when we've engaged with local community leaders to understand what the barriers are to even using those types of isolation and quarantine locations, because oftentimes there are barriers to doing that in the community. Your program, KQED, has highlighted the really nice way in which we've responded to trying to think more long-term of getting people who are unsheltered to have shelter during this time, which I think is also a key part of this. But what we have to be doing is now thinking about more sustainable solutions. And I think my hope is that the partnerships that are really essential to both the acute response, particularly in the communities with the highest need and highest transmission, can be translated into a more sustained response to thinking across our sectors to what do we need in order to achieve better health more in the long term as well.
Yeah, well said. And let me read some comments that are coming in that are also many of them well said. This actually, we've been talking about trust, and here's a listener who says, there's no way I would get the Trump vaccine. Another listener says, all these those complicit in Trump's streamlining of our pandemic task force in 2018 and then lying to us about dangers of COVID-19 should be charged with crimes against humanity. This has been a colossal failure by Trump and his administration at the expense of American lives. Some strong sentiments here, to put it mildly. Here's Susan, who writes, Trump once said that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose supporters. Now it seems he won't lose supporters even when he's willing to shoot them by discouraging them to protect themselves with masks. And Denise says, I feel that the best words to describe the current resident of the White House is cult leader, and cult members will never believe or recognize the truth about the COVID virus. And those of you who defend the president, please feel free to express yourself here. I'm going to go to a question, though, from a listener named Ned. And James Hamlin, Dr. Hamlin, I'm going to ask you to respond to Ned. He writes, in February, the FDA's poor decision in only focusing on the CDC to make a test
Hello.
Kit.
Hello. Can you guys hear me?
We got some crosstalk there. In February, the FDA's poor decision in only focusing on the CDC to make a test kit, and then the CDC's incompetence in getting a test kit, but out-destroyed the country's chances to contain the virus in early hotspots. How important were these factors in containing the virus, and why don't these factors get more attention?
Early testing, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities. Sorry, there's a buzzer. There's going to be a lot of opportunity to litigate early responses to who could have done what better. Right now, we need to focus on getting rapid testing out and approved and making sure it's vetted appropriately. We absolutely could have moved more quickly on testing, and the exact degree to which that would have changed the course of the pandemic, I'm hesitant to think that it would have just because of the disinformation and downplaying of numbers that continued from the White House, but that in the hands of, you know, a capable leadership and with a real interest in transparency and containing the virus could have very well led us at least to be more meticulous and to be more specific in how we were rolling out shutdowns, whereas instead we sort of had to flip this switch and just say, well, you know, everybody in entire large cities just shelter in place indefinitely, which is not an ideal situation. Usually you can have more concrete and targeted plans for how and exactly when people need to shelter in place.
What about the example of Germany? I'm struck by the fact that they had full shutdowns that led to major caseload drops and ended with an ability to implement widespread testing and tracing to contain cases before they actually turned into outbreaks. All this done within a specific time frame. I think you could argue that supporting that would be maybe make more sense. And I think you do argue this, don't you, in one of your articles in The Atlantic. If you did this in a couple of weeks and just had a total shutdown, as opposed to being in this limbo where you open up and then you find you have to shut down again and then you open up and so forth. I mean, this is maddening. This is like being in Dante's Inferno or something.
Yeah, I know. It's very frustrating and difficult for everyone. It's at least a possibility that I've explored, you know, I heard from an email correspondence with Dr. Fauci a couple weeks ago. He was saying we really need to get our national case numbers down to about 10,000. And we'd been writing at about 40,000 a day at that point, and now we're creeping up. Last I saw was 48,000. So the logical end point there, the only way that you could cut your case counts by 75% in a matter of a couple weeks would be a complete shutdown. We've not seen that sort of drop at any point. I'm not suggesting that's what we should do, and actually we wouldn't be capable of it because we don't operate we have a much more localized state-oriented systems of public health. There are good things about that and there are bad, but one basic fact of it is we're not going to have a national mandate that every place does exactly the same thing. So that's part of our issue is we've seen abilities of certain cities to really clamp down and shut down and drop their case counts pretty quickly. But people move across the country, go to places where things aren't shut down, and our national numbers end up looking like this long, bleak plateau.
Well, there's a doctor named Stephen Thomas, who I know you've interviewed, an infection disease expert at State University upstate New York, who says you got to play chess, not checkers. It's an interesting metaphor to use. He's talking about, in other words, a group of practices that minimize the spread. You use drugs, you use behavior, you use whatever you can, more masks. And by the way, flu shots would be in order here for many people. But the usual things, distancing wearing a mask, of course. But it also talks about living like you are contagious. And that's, I think, a useful thing to think about. Someone coughs or someone sneezes, immediately exhale. But, you know, think of yourself as constantly, as best you can, minimizing unnecessary contributions of the virus to the air around you, because these are indeed what we have to be so concerned about now and what is being downplayed in the politicizing.
Yeah, you know, honestly, for as complex as so much of this is, if every single person were really able to behave as though they were emitting virus all the time and thinking about their breath and thinking about how close they're getting to other people and just being conscious of making sure you're not infecting other people or doing things that might lead other people to be infected, that would leave us in a place where our case counts would be extremely low. I can't say it would be totally gone, but that is probably just a key idea, that when you're doing so much of the distancing and masking, just thinking about, imagine that I am, you know, putting virus out into the world. How do I go about my life as best possible without, you know, getting anyone else sick? Even if you're not feeling anything, you've had no high-risk contacts, just try to live like that as best you can.
I'd like to hear you weigh in on this, if I could, Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo.
Yes, I totally agree, and I really really like this article from James. I think that the challenge in the pandemic is that, you know, we're going to be living with this virus for a while, right? And we have to adopt all of those small personal behaviors that all contribute in a large way to making our own environments, ourselves safe, but also the environments and the people we come in contact safe. And that's got to be the hallmark of the way we start thinking about it. And it really is the challenge in the way we have been thinking about it is this extreme of opening versus closing. I think it's what really sets us up for that zigzag response that we've seen in the cases. We have never gotten down to anywhere close to the level of case counts that other countries that have taken some aspect of a response incredibly seriously across their entire country. We've never done that as a country. And I think that that we have to start taking all of these little things that we each personally can do and that we can do locally and in our local communities. And those are the things that are going to add up on over time. I will also say that as much as we're fretting about the national response, it is worth shouting out, I think, our regional response here in the Bay Area, our response here in San Francisco, where we have had a lot of successes. And I think in the absence of a clear federal response, we have to really empower our local and regional leaders, both our elected officials as well as our community leaders, to think about all of the actions we can do to keep our own communities safe.
Well, thank you for that reminder about keeping the focus on the local. I think it's extremely important. And I also think it's important to tell you that this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. You're listening to Forum, and I'm Michael Krasny. And I'm going to go to some more of your comments that are coming in here. A lot of them are strongly anti-Trump comments. If someone wants to defend the president, you're certainly welcome to join us with email or phone calls. Frank writes, Donald Trump minimizes all aspects of the pandemic. This is consistent with something from a national adversary, such as Russia, which has ill will toward the U.S. Alicia says, I have neighbors who have recently recovered from COVID. They are Latino, and I noticed that they frequently have prayer meetings in their home. They shared with me that faith will protect us from getting a bad case of COVID. None of them wear masks. Another listener, Noel, tweets, anyone who would listen to a real estate con man over the medical community should not be taken seriously. Another example of the general public's lack of understanding of science. And a listener writes, the root problem is a large number of people who will do what Trump says, no matter how ludicrous. We need to know how to do mass intervention to cure. He's not talking about COVID. I think he's talking about derangement, as some call it. And to get back to this notion of herd immunity, because people often bring up Sweden, and a listener tweets, and I'm going to go to you, this is James Hamlin. Listener says, Sweden also has greater social cohesion and trust in government, so they voluntarily did the things the government asked them to do. And when I started asking you about, you know, the lieutenant governor of Ohio saying wear a mask and people booing him and everything, this gets right to the heart of this listener's tweet. There is less social cohesion here, or less of, maybe some would call it more rebelliousness or contrariness. That's American.
Right. We're seeing a lot of cohesion too. You know, I mean, I don't, I don't want to downplay. A lot of people have been just really vigilant and great about following public health directives and are doing their part. I'd say most Americans are. But it does certainly make it easier. You know, it requires less legislative action, less actual enforcement of saying we're going to shut down, you know, no restaurants are allowed to have tables within X number of feet of one another. If restaurants simply do it, you know, or if you simply push people outside, or if people are just being vigilant about hand washing and distancing and not going out when they're sick, you know, the more of that that happens organically because people care about their communities and other citizens and not spreading the virus, you know, the lower case counts stay, the less becomes necessary to actually enforce things like that at a policy level. And the more that then your policymakers are free to focus on things like how do we scale up, you know, testing and how do we invest in research into vaccines and focus on forward thinking measures. And that seems to be the way that countries with, as you suggest, maybe more social cohesion or simply a more nationally, federally centric public health system have been successful.
And if I could go back to you, Dr. Bibbins-Domingo, we're coming to the close of this hour, but I'm interested in hearing what you have to say just about the lack of certainty in so many areas. We're still learning an immense amount because we don't know an immense amount about this virus.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We've talked a lot about the political process. One thing that has been really remarkable during this time is how scientists of all different, with all different types of tools have come together to really tell us over an incredibly short period of time how much more about how this virus does its work, how it infects, what types of things predispose to worse outcomes, what types of things we can do to develop new treatments, how do we think about immunity in this context. And I think it's really remarkable what we have achieved actually in a learning about the virus and parlaying that information into therapeutics and other types of public health interventions. And unfortunately, that sometimes gets lost because we're fearful. It's a dangerous time. We'd like all of this to happen more quickly. But there has been really extraordinary science, and I think that does give me hope that we will get through this, but I think we're in a challenging time when the messaging about that is much more challenging to understand.
On that note of hope, what Emily Dickinson called the thing with feathers, let me conclude this and thank both of you very much for being with us for this whole segment of Forum. Again, Kristen Bibbins-Domingo is professor and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UCSF School of Medicine. And James Hamlin is physician and staff writer for The Atlantic and co-host of the Social Distance podcast. And we are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated in the evening. And we always invite you to let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Tomorrow during this hour, we're going to talk about colleges and particularly about community colleges in the CSU system. And stay tuned for an hour with Mina Kim. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, take care. Stay safe. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.